Eric slammed the brakes hard, and Drover nearly pitched out himself as the others were smashed forwards, but it was too late. The mule ground to a halt, muddy red tracks left in its wake, and from the cabin, Barrack shouted a raft of expletives. After he'd recovered, the two-way Vox receiver in the flatbed hissed, and his voice crackled through.
"Who was that? What the hell was that?"
Picking herself up, Morgravia answered,
"One of Farkoum's harem."
"What did you do?"
"Nothing. Damn your soul. She did it herself."
Drover had leapt down to the ground, landing in a crouch.
"As we're stopping, someone should keep a watch," he said.
Morgravia agreed and tossed him the shotgun, which he caught deftly as he moved to the front of the rig. She heard him whistle as he inspected the carnage. She heard the low thrum of shrouded engines, like a lander or a gun cutter on mute. But looking into the night sky, she couldn't discern anything unusual, just smoke and darkness.
"You hear that?"
she asked of no one in particular. Then something moved nearer the ground. Morgravia saw it flicker in her peripheral vision and turned her head to try to track it. Nothing.
"Get us moving, Barrack," she said into the Vox receiver.
The sky still looked clear.
"She's entangled in the drive axle,"
he called back, having stepped out of the cabin to take a look himself.
"Merciful throne."
Morgravia went to the trailer edge and leaned over, acutely aware of the broker watching silently. She had sat up, the sommelier still close. Drover wandered into her eyeline, coming from the front of the rig.
"It's a mess. Strings of meat, cracked bone, hair."
Morgravia scowled.
"Barrack, get us moving, now. Loitering in the open is a very bad idea."
She hadn't seen or heard anything of Farkoum or Karata, and she assumed the fat merchant had no opinion of the ugly death of his slave.
"I see something."
It was Drover who spoke, slowly walking the perimeter of the mule, shotgun at the ready. Morgravia followed his gaze, briefly wishing she hadn't surrendered the weapon. A soft chime emanated from the darkness, like metal ringing against metal. A scrape followed, metallic like the first sound. A butcher sharpening his knives. Another chime pealed from the north, the same pattern repeating. Then from the south, east, and west. Chime, scrape. Chime, scrape. Drover had roamed farther out, muzzle switching between cardinal points, all the while the metallic refrain growing louder. Morgravia recalled him, kicking out the trailer's rear ramp so that it slammed down to the ground.
"Back here, now!"
Drover turned, about to say something pithy, but thought better of it when he saw Morgravia's face. He slung the shotgun on its strap and hurried back to the trailer, scurrying aboard with a hand up from the Inquisitor before helping pull up the ramp. The engine surged, a high-pitched shriek that set their teeth on edge. The front wheel turned on the right-hand side, and the rig slewed in a half-circle, kicked out of true by the sticking left wheel. Watery red lamps flared in the shadows, distant but becoming more distinct. Chime, scrape. Chime, scrape. A veritable chorus sang out the butcher's song. The red lamps multiplied into a crimson constellation.
"Let's get underway,"
Morgravia urged down the Vox. The engine replied, shrieking, the rig turning as the rear wheels propelled it around the sticking drive axle. They were almost facing back the way they had come.
"Barrack? I'm damn well trying."
The circle of red lamps closed, hot embers now, unfettered by distance or the thready smoke still clouding the township. A noose enclosed, one with sharp paring blades.
Chime, scrape. Chime, scrape.
Drover still had the shotgun and panned it full circle, following the sounds. Morgravia had pulled her knife and turned to the others in the trailer. Her gaze fell on the broker and the sommelier in particular.
"Are you prepared to fight?"
The sommelier, already standing, conceded the slightest nod, and Morgravia swore she saw his arms tense inside the folds of his robes. She imagined a weapon concealed beneath, one the sommelier was well practiced with. Even the scribe, Archyle, since Drover had given him the talk, had found a crowbar, and clung to it with both quivering hands.
Karata! Mulgravia snarled down the vox. Get your sorry carcass up here with the rest of us, or is the scribe who near pissed himself the braver man?
There was a moment's pause, in which those inside the trailer watched the periphery and the red lamps burning. Mulgravia squinted as a figure started to resolve. Metallic, spindle-limbed, blades for arms. The sight of it stirred something in her besides fear. A vague memory, which coalesced only to scatter like a wisp of smoke against the wind. She felt her scars itch, the slow and agonizing unstitching of flesh, the physical abuses of her body. She knew this thing, or its ilk, the cyborganic butchers of the heretic Mechanicus. What past transgression, what blight against reason had Blackgeist committed to bring these flesh carvers and technological perversions to its door? Mulgravia dearly wanted a gun. Instead, she called to Drover.
There!
The spindle thing ran, breaking from the circling pack, its reverse canted legs pistoning hard. Drover's blast hit it left of middle, forcing its shoulder to dip and turn. It stumbled, fragments falling from its skeletal frame. The eye burned, hate red.
Kill it!
Mulgravia shouted. A second burst riddled its torso, tearing out wires in a flash of sparks. Oil and vital fluid sprayed its countenance, where a mouthpipe bulged with laboured intensity. It got 10 feet from the trailer when Drover took off its head, neck, and part of its clavicle. It collapsed into a mire of its own fluids, limbs twitching like a dead arachnid. Dover clacked a fresh round into the shotgun's breech.
What the throne is that?
Only the first, Mulgravia replied. Two more were coming, barreling on all four limbs, back legs kicking as the blade arms dug into the ground and propelled them. The first spun on its heel, back leg shot out, opposite front limb torn off as Karata demonstrated the stopping power of his flechette pistol. Good of you to join us, Mulgravia wanted to say, but settled for withering contempt in her gaze instead. It kept going, the spindle thing, crawling and scraping on one leg, one arm, before a flechette round to the head ended it. Drover took out the other one, cleaner this time, having now assessed his enemy, a focused blast to the skull, leaving it decapitated and floundering as it skidded onto its front and slid to stillness.
Barak!
Mulgravia roared. The engine roared too, harder this time, as Barak hammered the fuel pedal. The mule whirled so sharply, the broker tipped out, shrieking a little as she did so. Without a moment's hesitation, the sommelier leapt after her, his robes parting to reveal a battle harness underneath. A long, chained whip unfurled, its segmented parts snapping like a tongue as the sommelier energized each link. It lashed out, carving two more spindle things to wreckage, cleaving through metal with horrific ease. They discombobulated where they stood, torso, limbs and face pulled apart by simple gravity as they were separated. The broker crawled, reaching her formidable protector as he looped the whip around, scything at the spindle things as they rushed in. She kept going, getting back to the rig where Mulgravia leaned down to haul her up, grunting with the weight of the broker's augmetics. Drover and Karata fended off the rest as they piled in, a machine herd, bent on slaughter. This wasn't the plague, the ravening, as the Drover had referred to it. It had the hallmarks of a purge, a determined and thorough execution and eradication. Miga had been cleared out, and now just the dregs remained. Mulgravia amongst them. Illegal psykers, mutants, heretic cults, each were worthy of such focused pogroms. But the motivation here was beyond her ability to currently fathom. At least Barak freed the drive axle, grinding away whatever bone and matter had gummed its workings. The mule lurched, but then turned, its forward momentum restored. The broker was shouting from the back of the trailer, her usual composure fracturing under the very real and present threat to her sommelier, who fought ferociously as the spindle things came for him. Drover sent forth another blast, and even Karata added to the fusillade. But the Mechanicus killers were numerous, and they were fast. They swarmed the sommelier, cutting him off from the rig. His eyes met with the broker's, a momentary connection that suggested he had a good degree more sentience than Morgravia had first given him credit for. He didn't cry out or plead for rescue, or even urge the others on. He simply fought. That one look he gave to his mistress, the only indication of his will. But he couldn't engage them all, and the overspill made for the rig, blade limbs scything, legs poised to spring.
Move, damn it, Barrack! Get us out of here now!
Wheels spinning in the sludge, the rig sped off, kicking up filth in its wake. Clinging to the back wall of the trailer, the broker stared as the sommelier fought. The machines flocked him, only kept at bay by the fatal revolutions of his whip. She stared until the fight had become a smudge, and then nothing but a memory as the darkness claimed it. Even then she stared, her eyes on the night, listening to the distant chimes of battle, until even they fell still, and all was shadow and silence again. Only then did she release her grip. Only then did she retreat from the wall and turn her gaze upon Morgravia. The rig rumbled on as the precinct house grew ever closer, and in the night sky, faint and distant, crimson lights. Chapter 15. Ruination. The blade felt sharp against the skin, tucked just under the jugular. A quick slash and the carotid would open, spilling a river of red. This was the first thing Christo thought of as he regained consciousness. The second was simply, "I'm alive." Relief quickly turned to fear, the revelation coming as he opened his eyes and saw men gathered around them. A circle of masks, ragged strips of robes masking old military fatigues or factorum uniforms. One of those masks regarded him. The eyes that were visible through the slits, bright and azure, like chips of sapphire. It wore a simulacrum of a blank face. The strange figure, and his dirty red vestments, smelled of cloying incense and blood, as if one had been deployed to obscure the other. Instead, both mingled into something noisome. Christo glanced about, only moving his eyes. He counted seven more figures, thuggish kinds, with masks of saints or laurel-crowned paragons. Two wore the faces of eagles. The Aquila daubed their attire, roughly drawn, a dark stain that reminded Christo of blood. Cudgels and rusty knives hung from studded leather belts. A few had a flagellant binding rope lashed around their ankles, the dried matter trailing from its inward-facing spikes like little tears of penance. Some carried trophies. Christo saw bones, a rotting skull. They stank, despite the effort of cloves and garlic to suppress their foul odour. The one with the knife, it was silver, double-edged, and had the ornate look of an athame, leaned in to speak into Christo's ear. His breath reeked of soiled meat.
"Weary traveller,"
his voice slid with the honey of a practised demagogue.
"I am called Convocation, and these are my flock, the Divine. Zealots, Low Sink had them in abundance. Most deprived settlements did, their easy charms and false promises playing well with the disenfranchised and the desperate. Ordinarily, the proctors would suppress their bolder ambitions, but the Lex had departed Meager altogether and left something primal in its place. Gang rule was now the only law, and the largest gang of all was that of the Imperial cult. Power abhors a vacuum, or so Christo had heard it said, an old phrase from old lips, but it held true, and in the absence of the proctors, a new law had arisen. Belatedly, Christo realised the skulls hanging off their belts were of the infected. Distended and emaciated, they could be no other. Then he saw Corinna and Celestia pushed to their knees, hands bound behind their heads, and Christo tried to rise. The knife bit, deep enough to sting and draw a thick crimson rivulet
that beaded down the blade.
No, the priest called convocation said. You stay.
Don't,
Christo snarled. But convocation smiled, certain of his absolute dominion.
Tell me, brother of man, he said, like a mendicant in search of alms. Do you believe in the Emperor's light and righteous judgment?
Two burly zealots hauled Christo up, one wearing a Hessian hood emblazoned with the eagle, the other an angelic mask. The latter's false face only came halfway down his features. A stubbled chin was left jutting and exposed, and in direct opposition to the serenity evoked by his porcelain visage. They had short-hafted maces looped to a length of rope that tied their makeshift robes together. Heavy boots and coarse fabrics were just visible beneath. Christo thought he caught the fringe of a partly hidden proctor's uniform on one of them. Make an already weak man feel powerless, and watch him join the first cult that offers him succour. Convocation kept the knife close throughout Christo's rough handling, an eagerness for violence lighting his eyes. Christo gave the priest no cause to act upon it, even when they dragged Corinna and Celestia to their feet too. Eight further masked figures emerged through the murk and the rain like pale spectres. A few wielded spiked clubs, improvised lengths of timber with nails punched through the ends. Two carried large hammers. Several had pistols tucked in their rude belts. One had an autogun slung over her shoulder on a strap. Begrimed, raggedly attired but so armed, they had the look of psychotic beggars. Convocation withdrew, but didn't speak. Instead, he gestured with the ritual knife. Two flicks of the wrist, a feudal lord ordering his vassals, and Christo was ushered forwards. Then began a slow march through the ruins of Meager. Abandoned buildings gave hollow greeting as they passed. Fires still burned in some places. In the distance, an old watchtower spewed out smoke. A sense of profound absence had taken the town. Death had swept through it, death and fear, leaving it raw and exposed like a wound. It was quiet now, barring the rain. But so is a cemetery. Christo tried not to imagine the lives lost or those who had succumbed to the contagion sweeping the districts. He had his head down for most of the march, trying to think, to plan a way out. Corinna and Celestia were kept behind him, their fate concealed also, and Christo thought it was probably a means to keep him in line. Not that he was in much fit state to do anything other than comply. He had slept earlier, at least. He didn't know for how long, and it had been a fitful rest brought on by exhaustion. The priest had fed him a pungent draught that Christo had tried to refuse at first, but then rough hands had gripped his arms, his neck, before levering open his jaw, and he had drunk. It tasted vile, like strong hooch, and he thought it drugged, but it had invigorated him, even quenching a little of his thirst.
"Where are you taking us?"
he asked, but convocation didn't answer. They marched in silence, a column of pilgrims being led to paradise. Except Christo thought his idea of what that meant might differ from what it meant for the priest and his flock. They were lean folk, their eyes hard and hungry, sustained by will, or, more accurately, the fear of what convocation might do to them if they defied him. Christo knew Meager had fallen far. But for its people to accept such demagogues unflinchingly and absolutely in such a short span of time told him exactly how far. That they encountered none of the dead was the only saving grace. Christo feared for his daughter and for Celestia, not because of what the zealots might do to them, but because he felt powerless to prevent it. By the time they reached the gaping maw of the Maglev tunnel, that fear hadn't lessened. Apart from the uninviting dark and the cold and existential dread that comes from staring into an abyssal void, the first thing that struck Christo was the smell. Something had died in that tunnel. It had become a burial place, a tomb of the unquiet. He had no wish to go that way, and even less for his daughter to accompany him.
"What is this?"
he asked, slowing his footfalls and feeling the resistance of the two men charged with his compliance. Convocation had lifted the knife from his throat and now paced alongside Christo. Surprisingly, he answered.
"Salvation," the priest smiled, but it was humourless, a product of cruelty and mania. "Perhaps."
"You sound doubtful about that."
Convocation tutted, a lecturer telling off a foolish student.
"Not doubt. Though," he conceded, "not everyone can be saved. To be judged, one must first enter the dark and see into their immortal soul."
And so they did. At Convocation's gentle urging, Christo was led into the maglev tunnel, and the rest of the pilgrims followed. A chill touched the air, redolent of a butcher's meat locker. Old blood spoiling flesh and the actinic tang of active magnetism ran riot across his tongue. His nose wrinkled at the stench of it. Darkness swept down on him, tenebrous and abject. It smothered him. He was immediately blind and forced to rely on his other senses for navigation. More than once he slipped, near twisting his ankle. The live maglev rail hummed in his right ear, promising a swift death. Break from his captors, leap onto the rail. It would be easy enough. As his minders backed off, Christo suspected Convocation was testing his resolve.
"You'll have to kill me first,"
he whispered, to which he heard to his dismay,
"Good, good,"
and knew he had been right. The dead found them here, in dribs and drabs, in a part of the tunnel where the lights yet flickered. Nothing like the horde that had swept Meager and gutted it. Spiked clubs, maces and staves did for these pitiable creatures, their gaunt faces rendered up in spastic flashes of cold grey light. They were slower than the ones Christo had previously encountered, and he wondered if this enervation was somehow symptomatic of whatever contagion had infected the populace. Certainly it made them easier to kill, which the zealots did with unfettered abandon. It was savage, gratuitously violent, and it took Christo a few moments to realise what it actually was. Anointment, a baptism in blood. The masks came back, rubricated.
"And so we are judged,"
he heard Convocation murmur. Eventually the tunnel opened out, still illuminated in spasms, but here the light described a subterranean station, more or less intact. Christo could scarcely believe his eyes when he saw the functioning Magtrans carriage aloft a few inches off the humming rail. More of the infected lingered here, though they were skeletal, emaciated, and beyond the point of perambulation, wallowing, grasping impotently, teeth bared in a permanent grimace, wasted, like flames deprived of air and close to extinction. He stared as he passed them, then kept staring as they mounted the Magtrans, and it ferried them deeper into hell. Chapter 16. The Fortress. It stood, empty and silent, like a ransacked tomb. A fortress sacked but unsullied. The rig drove through into the yard through an open gateway, unseen and unremarked. Sentinel watchtowers loomed, but did no more than cast long shadows. Beyond them, beyond the perimeter wall, lay the keep itself, stout buttressed flanks, a ferrocrete stockade crowned by razor wire. Auto-sentry guns jerked with spasmodic motion recognition. Their ammo hoppers bled dry. The most heavily guarded and well-fortified structure in all of Meager. Precinct 9. The Proctor's last redoubt. In the end, it had not availed them. A carpet of shell casings crunched under the rig's tread, pushed into the dirt like brass seedlings as it trundled past. A ramp led to a canopied depot, its parking zones also empty. Barrack, still brought the vehicle to a halt within the chevroned lines, habit harder to break than the ex-lawman's spirit. He wore a stony expression as they brought Jaina out from the back of the cabin, Maela assisting her as she climbed down the short ladder. She stepped gingerly on her wounded leg, the pain obvious from her pinched features. Barak took her then, clasping his wife's hand as if to try to squeeze the hurt out of her, or perhaps absorb it into himself. He wrapped his arm around her back, gently holding her up as they walked the approach road to the keep's entrance. The others followed, weary from the ride, a few casting nervous glances at the darkness they had left behind them. Nothing had followed, at least nothing that could be seen or heard. The broker had fallen into silence and melancholy, the loss of the sommelier more akin to that of a loved one than the indentured slave he had appeared to be. Farkum and his man muttered to one another, the fat merchant dragging Maela close, like one might cling to his property in the presence of a thief. Her scorn kept the worst of his pawing at bay, a resilience having flourished in her since Hallow's End and everything that had come after. Barak looked about to intervene, but a careful glance from Maela warned him off. "See to her," it said, and he did. Before Barak reached the entrance, Morgravia cut him off, Drover in tow. "Why would they leave the keep?" she asked.
"Your guess is as good as mine," Barak frowned. "Could be the entire precinct got deployed."
"And they happened to leave open the gate behind them?"
"Fair point."
Morgravia gestured to Drover, who looked back at her mildly aghast, poking a finger against his own chest.
"You've got the gun, hireling," she explained.
He had smoked his cigar down to the nub and clenched it between his teeth, puffing a slow purplish smoke trail as he said,
"Best see if anyone's home then, eh?"
Shotgun held at waist height, Drover ducked inside. The lumens ignited with a flash of sodium brightness, a heavy clunk echoing through the barren complex as Drover threw the lever. Having made it as far as the generator room, and now returned to a wide, dirty lobby, the nerves of the party began to ease. Barak had secured the entrance, the door sealed behind manual slide bolts, and had procured lock codes from behind the raised pulpit where the proctors processed their intake. Procedurally, it appeared little had changed since his tenure as a lawkeeper. Each lock code was a sheaf of parchment like a wafer, but hardened to the stiffness of plastic. And Barak showed them to the group as they gathered around him.
"Armory, ammunition store, mess hall, med bay, and vox station," he said, leafing through the cards like a street gambler explaining a lure to his marks. "Pair up. Divide the tasks between us," said Morgravia, and no one contradicted her. Lessened in agency or not, she was still Inquisition, and that commanded a certain measure of obedience.
"Well, I for one will feel better when I've fed my children," said Drover, patting his auto pistols.
He then unhooked the shotgun and threw it back to Morgravia, who caught it deftly. He took the lock code for the ammunition store and wrapped an arm around Arkyle's back as he moved off.
"You're with me, partner."
"You know what you're looking for?"
Morgravia called. Drover eyed the hefty sidearm holstered to the Inquisitor's belt.
"I'm guessing cannon shells."
Morgravia smiled thinly, her eyes betraying her amusement.
"You'll do just fine."
She turned to Barak. "You and I are going to the armory," she told him. He cast a glance at his wife, who he had left in Maella's care. The courtesan held her close, Jaina barely lucid in that moment.
"I will take her," she said. "The med bay."
Farkum grunted something to Karata, prompting the hired gun to step forwards.
"I'll go with them," he uttered, eyes cold. "For protection."
Barak began to mouth a protest, but Morgravia stepped in.
"Now, why do I think you're more concerned about your master's property than getting this injured woman to the med bay?" Karata shrugged.
Like I give a shit what you think.
Morgravia let her gaze linger on him just long enough that he knew she'd kill him if anything happened to either of the two in his charge. Then turned back to Barak. You know the armory. You know the guns. And you're another pair of hands that I trust. He nodded by way of agreement, though still didn't look happy about the arrangement with Karata.
Then I shall procure sustenance, said the broker,
having reasserted her air of calm. Whatever grief or blame she harboured for the sommelier's fate, she kept it hidden for now. The mess hall was closest to the entrance. It was visible from the lobby. It therefore didn't surprise Morgravia when Farkum went with the broker. The lobby was a hub with several avenues all trailing off from its main nexus. A map mounted on the wall made navigation easier. The precinct house was a fortified keep, but it wasn't huge. Three floors, one sub-basement where the cells and archives were located. This area would remain sealed. According to Barak, it also ran on a separate generator, so the lights would still be out. Nothing down there for us, thought Morgravia, and followed Barak towards the armory. Stripped, almost bare, the main armory was a sorry sight.
Is this it?
Asked Morgravia, scowling.
Precincts only got this one cache.
A pair of shotguns, three stub pistols, one autogun, a few sodium lanterns, and a belt of tear gas grenades. It wasn't much. They took everything.
Here,
said Barak, throwing Morgravia a handheld Vox. She caught it and checked the power. A rasp of static issued out. Barak snagged its twin to his belt.
Channel 2,
he said, having already clicked it into place on his own Vox. Morgravia nodded and did the same.
What about the sub-basement?
She asked, reassessing her earlier assumption as she armed up. She took one of the shotguns, a lantern, and a stub pistol. Like a pack horse, Barak carried the rest. The ex-proctor rubbed at his stubbled chin.
Could be something useful. There's a few old stores down there, mainly machine parts back in the day, but that might have changed. It's worth a try.
She hefted the shotgun. It was weighty, reassuring. We won't get far on these. Barak raised an eyebrow.
How far do we need to go?
Hive Edge, to the gate. We need to move up Hive and quickly. She didn't mention that she had other concerns, ones that might mean spending more time in low sink. That would all depend on the broker giving up the location of the empath. Up until now, Morgravia had been focused on survival. But with the immediate danger past, a different imperative took hold.
Won't the gate be sealed?
Not for me. That, too, was misleading. She doubted she would be headed to the gate, and so she needed to find another way to ensure it remained unbarred for Barak and the others. A problem for later, although not much later.
Okay, then,
Barak replied, and something in his tone suggested scepticism. Lying, for an inquisitor, was like breathing. Perhaps she was losing her touch. As she slung the shotgun over her shoulder, Morgravia noticed a barrack room leading off from the corridor to the armory.
Is there a washroom back there?
She asked, feeling the patina of grit and dirt crusting her body. She needed a bath, a shower, something. Right now, she'd settle for semi-clean water and a hose.
Should be a basin or two, said Barak. You feeling all right?
Tired.
You want me to wait?
Find your wife.
What about the stores in the sub-basement?
I'll deal with those. Barak nodded, grateful. Before he left, he said,
I saw you collapse, back in the bar.
He held up his hands.
I'm not prying, I'm not. Just want to make sure I'm doing the right thing by leaving you.
Morgravia smiled, a loyal and dutiful man. That was rare in her experience.
I've faced the devils of the abyss, Barak. I've stared them down and vanquished them with this very hand.
She showed him.
The chivalry is appreciated, but I'll be fine.
Barak nodded, but lingered. Those machines. You want to know what they were?
Not really. I'd rather not know anything about your world. Mine was bleak enough, serving the Lex. I can't imagine the burdens of knowledge an Inquisitor has to deal with.
Are they anything to do with me?
Yes. I think that they probably are.
Will you stop them? Can you?
I am the Emperor's servant, was all Mulgravia said.
Barak's face suggested he doubted that would be enough. Then he said,
outside the bar, before we left, before it burned to the ground, I saw lights in the sky, red lights, and then a high-pitched shrieking. I've heard that sound before, or at least something similar. A mining tool. Sonics. It's used for digging. No Blackgeist mining consortium is burrowing for ore when all this shit is going on, at least not one in low sink. I doubt any are left.
Could it be related to the other machines?
I'm assuming you didn't just crack skulls as a proctor. I was an investigator too. Pretty good one, I'd say. Had my moments. So, what do you think?
Mulgravia paused, considering how much she should say.
I saw them too. The lights. Didn't hear the shriek, but I did hear something else. Engine drone, low, masked. Something small, like a gun cutter. Do the proctors have anything like that?
Barak shook his head.
Not in my day. Besides, proctors are noisy. Bright lamps, loud engines, dominate, subdue, and control. Not big on stealth.
Another unanswered question, then.
I think they're looking for something, and they don't want anyone else to know they're doing it.
Who's they?
I hoped you might have an idea.
I might.
Care to share?
Not just yet.
Let's focus on gearing up and getting out. Something's off about this place. I don't think we should overstay.
Fair enough.
See how your wife is doing. Then meet back at the lobby.
That seemed to satisfy Barak, who nodded, then went on his way. Once he was gone, Mulgravia entered the barrack room and found the two basins he had spoken of. A cracked mirror reflected a haggard face back at her. Dark rings around the eyes had the appearance of coal, and the skin was pale. Still, the features were strong, the expression resolute. Mulgravia turned the faucet, releasing a slow but steady stream. After a few seconds, the briny appearance of the water cleared, and she cupped her hands to make a reservoir, splashing her face. It felt warm but wet, and some of the grime washed away, leaving dark trails in the sink. She found a cloth, wiped the back of her neck, and ran a hand through her silver mohawk, finding it wretched with gritty particulate. She stared, one ice-blue eye, the other jaundiced and bloodshot, staring back. And then she saw it, a reflection of light on the mirror, momentary but not imagined. Her ice-blue eye flashed, a ripple of brilliance through the sclera, like a bionic. Mulgravia had no bionics. She gripped the basin with one hand, tentatively touching the edge of her eye with the other. She was breathing hard, fast. Her heart galloped. She felt around her eye socket, gently probing. It was cold, colder than the rest of the skin around it. Another flare of light, this time unmistakable, azure, clean. She discerned focusing rings, turning slowly on concentric arcs. She probed deeper, wriggling a finger into the tear duct, searching for a gap. She found resistance. Metal. Both hands suddenly clenched the edge of the basin, as Mulgravia almost fell, and the red dream lingered, eager for release.
A mind without purpose will walk in dark places, she murmured, looking down as she repeated the words like a mantra.
She'd read them in an old book several years ago, surprised at the clarity of recall. Taking a breath, she looked up. Nothing had changed. No horrific transformation had taken place, and the eye seemed like an eye again. But she knew. She knew. In that moment, her scars took on fresh meaning. Hurriedly, a rising fear in her gut, threatening to overwhelm her if she didn't do it quickly, she undid the flak weave and removed the tunic underneath. She stood naked from the waist up, examining the roadmap of pain traced across her body. Old wounds presented themselves, bullet holes, abrasions, stabbings. But the longer scars reminded her of a clothier's markings and the segmenting of material. She had been re-sewn like a garment. She had no idea why, but felt the presence of something parasitical within. She, its host. Pressing her fingers against the edge of a thready cicatrice running down her sternum, she began to dig with her nails. It hurt, but only a little, as if some of the nerve endings had been scraped away, and blood started to bead. A vox crackled, stopping Morgravia, releasing her. She blinked, and heard Drover's voice. For a second, she thought it was the handheld unit, but then realised it was coming through a fluted vox horn set in one corner of the barrack room, next to the ceiling.
"He's gone!" He sounded pained, angry. "The little shit's gone!"
Dragging on her tunic, Morgravia found the voxponder and spoke into the boxy unit's receiver cup.
"What's happening?"
she demanded. Her head felt heavy, hung over. She breathed deeply to clear the fogginess from her mind.
"Bastard hit me, hard, and he ran."
"Ran where? Who?
What the hell are you talking about, Drover? Are you at the ammunition store?" "Didn't get that far. Said he felt dizzy, so I went to find a canteen, some water. Next I know I'm on my knees, nursing a cracked skull."
Morgravia swore under her breath, then said,
"I think I know where he's going."
She turned, about to explain further, when she saw the broker standing in her way. The shotgun stood upright against the basin. She'd unslung it when she'd washed her face. The stub pistol lay on the basin's edge, well within the broker's grasp. Morgravia's monomolecular knife was still tucked in the back of her belt. Morgravia didn't move.
"I wondered when we'd have to do this."
Chapter 17. Evidence. As Barrack made his way to the medbay, he found bullet casings, lasburns on the walls, the parts of now tumble-down barricades. He had no doubt the proctors had been deployed in force, but whoever had been left had fought hard to try to hold the keep. Against whom, he didn't know. But the gangs had been growing bolder for years, and Meager was hardly a pillar of law and order to begin with. The few signs of incursion revealed little evidence to go on. 15 years since he had last trod these halls. In all that time, Precinct 9 had never looked so beleaguered. He also knew its ways, and had taken a shortcut in order to get to Jaina quicker. Upon happening on the shell casings, that goal had been subverted. Stooping to examine one of the spent casings, Barrack found the shards of something resembling a human cheekbone, only made from porcelain. At first, he thought it might have come from a doll or child's toy, but upon closer inspection, realised it was part of a mask, broken from a heavy blow and missed in the clean-up. He didn't know of any gangs that wore porcelain masks as their signature, but then it had been a while. He had passed several wanted edicts on his way through the precinct, the kind usually given to bounty hunters, for their kind was rife in Low Sink, the pickings of vagrants, gang leaders and other recidivists abundant enough to serve a great many private contractors. The proctors were known to occasionally enlist outside help, wherever a criminal element might be beyond their reach or means to apprehend or kill. Barrack couldn't remember seeing any porcelain masks or masks of any description amongst them, and figured he might have better fortune with the archive. The medbay resided on the third floor, but the archive would be here on this one. Reuniting with Jaina had been his utmost priority since leaving the armory, and he didn't like the thought of her or Myella with that bastard Karata, but he'd found a piece of evidence
and he knew he should follow his old instincts. All the talk with the Inquisitor had rekindled a desire he thought long extinguished. He was an investigator, and he yearned for answers, for the truth. And then there was the smell. Faint at first, but unmistakable now. It was rot and death. He followed it to the archive. A locked door barred entry. With a brief moment's hesitation, Barak shoulder-barged it. The lock broke, but something else had wedged the door, and it only opened a few inches. The reek intensified, foul enough to make Barak retch. He considered again the wisdom of breaching the door. In all his years as a proctor, he had never gone against his instincts. He had to know. Stepping back, he fired off two shots, their retorts deafeningly loud in the quiet corridor, and destroyed both hinges. The door fell back with the creak of old metal. It thudded heavily and left a rectangular void in its wake. Barak stepped up to it. A records cabinet lay across the threshold, the barricade keeping him out. He climbed over it. The second floor archive was more of an office. The proper historical records were kept in the sub-basement, but he reckoned the mask and the perp who wore it were likely to be referenced here. All thoughts of digging into it evaporated, though, when Barak discovered the cause of the smell. The watch captain was seated at his desk, the contents of his cranial cavity littering the opposite wall. Instinctively, the shotgun came up. A shell snapped into the breech. No movement came from inside, and the air smelled ripe. The watch captain had been dead a while and must have barricaded himself in while death reigned outside. Wrapping an old bar cloth around his nose and mouth, Barak moved in to investigate. A small, leather-bound journal lay open on the desk next to the watch captain. Barak picked it up, careful to avoid the sticky blood pool that had thickened to a syrup around the dead man's chair. A pistol lay, half-consumed in it, but Barak wasn't desperate enough for more ammo to attempt to retrieve it. A dead man's gun, especially when used for a self-inflicted wound, was a bad omen. He flicked through the journal, finding notes on criminal activities, names of informants, suspected gang territories and illegal enterprises. The usual material. A section had been devoted to a gang referred to as the Divine, a religious cult that had become more than a nuisance in the districts. The record mentioned burnings, abductions. The Divine were doomsayers, and while they had been tolerated, their influence had been growing and their behaviour more and more aberrant. Arrests had been made, confessions extracted. Proctors had identified what they thought was the Divine's main hideout, an old church on the outskirts of Miga at the Maglev North Terminus. Plans had been devised to storm the location and purge it, stamp out the fire before it grew into a conflagration. The riots put paid to that, as did the horror that followed. It made for harrowing reading. Lists of criminals gave way to lists of the dead, those proctors taken casualty by the growing civilian unrest. It referenced deployments, not just in Miga, but in other townships of low sink, like Fallow and Drudge, as well as the other parts of Blackgeist. The spread had been endemic to Low Hive. Most of this, Barak already knew, or had deduced. The last paragraph was effectively a suicide note. The one immediately preceding it chilled him like cryo ice. So absorbed was he in his reading, he had failed to appreciate the significance of the gentle fizz of activation emanating from the Pict screen in one corner of the room. Divided into four separate feeds, each focused on a part of the precinct house. Three of the images were crazed with static, representing signal loss. The fourth was grainy, but depicted the sub-basement and the cells. Not unusual for a watch captain to want to keep a close eye on his prisoners. Except in this case, most of the lights had been doused. The words in the journal returned to him. They appear to be agitated by light. Sodium lamps in the corridor leading to the cells still burned. The grayscale rendering of the Pict feed made the light watery. But Barak saw the shadow flit past all the same. Fresh fear overlaid that already cultivating in his gut, like a bacterial infection rapidly worsening. He tapped a few iron keys on a slate next to the screen, cycling to a different feed that offered a wider view of the corridor. The scribe, Archyle, had found his way to the sub-basement. Even with the poor resolution of the feed, he appeared manic. Inmates present an irritated state, their mood fractious and urgent. He scurried, his movements frenetic, stopping occasionally to scratch at his scalp or hunker down in the nook of the wall to gently rock on his heels. Complaints of headaches are common. He avoided the light or turned from it whenever he got too close. Violent outbursts, several deaths. He shuffled around in the darkness, searching for something. We lost four proctors, trying to keep them contained. Couldn't reach them, heard their screaming. We left them. Throne forgive us. Archyle found the secondary generator. Had to lock down the cells. Too many. Emperor, help us. Archyle threw the lever, and the lights flickered, once, twice, revealing what was inside the cells, and then held steady. Drover's voice burst through the precinct voximeters, and Barak nearly dropped his shotgun. He was trembling. He hadn't shaken this bad for 15 years. No, that was a lie. He had much more recently, back at Hallow's End. The last line in the journal imprinted itself in his mind. They were eating each other. Stuffing the journal into his pocket, Barak ran. He barreled through the halls of the precinct house, breath heaving, until he reached the medbay. We have to get out, he said, as he barged in, breathless. Then he frowned as he fully took in the scene. Where's Karata? Chapter 18. A Reckoning. The broker glanced at the gun, and then back at Morgravia. I don't need that to kill you, she said. Morgravia had guessed the broker would have protection that extended beyond the servants she had surrounded herself with. Something in the augmetics, she assumed. Haptic weapons, finger implants. And is that why you're here? I have every right to. Oh? How did you come to that conclusion?
He died.
We all die. Well, the Inquisitor conceded, most of us do. You need to be more specific. The weapons lit, an array of warm light glowing at the fingertips of the broker's right hand. Morgravia had goaded her, wanting to know what she was up against.
Do not be facetious, Inquisitor, the broker warned, emotion clouding her voice. It does not suit you.
That's fair, Morgravia conceded. Though you don't know he's dead.
I know.
Morgravia let that go too. You are not as cold as you make out, are you? She said. It was a deduction, not a question. Though you hide it